This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
If you're listening to this, you probably know that the United States of America gets involved in a lot of foreign wars. We all know the big ones: World War I, World War II, Korea, sort of, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iraq again. But before and in between all that, the story a lot of us heard in school is that the US military didn't get out much. Turns out, that's kind of a blatant lie. I'm gonna guess a lot of us don't know about the multiple Spanish-American wars, the wars that led up to the Battle of Little Bighorn, or the baffling number of times we invaded Mexico. Odds are, you've never even heard of things like the time the Marines invaded Taiwan or the Oconee Wars. I'm Trevor Cully, host of the new podcast America Secret Wars, where I am going to sit down with a guest in each episode and dive into the history of all the forgotten and overlooked times that the United States deployed military force against other nations. You can find America Secret Wars at secretwarspod.com, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to America Secret Wars, the podcast all about forgotten, overlooked, and deliberately buried times the United States has used military force to fight or occupy foreign soil. I'm your host, Trevor Cully, and today I have Bree Jensen of the Pontifacts podcast with me. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. You want to tell everybody a little bit about Pontifacts?
Yeah, so Pontifacts is a papal history podcast ranking all of the popes from Peter to Francis. In every episode, we go through the biography of a single pope. We contextualize their papacy in the history and time and dynamics of what was going on. And then we rank them based on very serious and objective categories, like what their face looked like and how scandalous they were.
Those are the best categories.
They're always a lot of fun.
Well, this podcast is definitely going to have its fair share of scandal, though I can't make many claims for how good anybody's face is going to look. Seeing as at least one of the faces we're going to talk about today is Osama bin Laden.
Oh, fantastic. Great.
So, Bree, just as a starting baseline, I like to ask, what was your relationship to history class like in high school? And I usually say, especially in relation to American history, which I think will be extra interesting coming from you.
Yeah. Well, history class in Canada is certainly focused on Canadian history at any level, whether you're starting in primary or through high school. Pretty much everything that you're going to cover, aside from, I believe, like the French Revolution, is Canadian history all the way through. So as somebody who does not enjoy Canadian history, that was always interesting. I didn't enjoy it, even though I loved history. So it was an interesting dynamic. But yes, any time that you have to deal with Canada, you have to deal with American history, because the two are inextricably linked, at least from this side.
Yes, the French Revolution, notable event of Canadian history.
I know, it was the one thing I got really excited about, because it wasn't Canadian history.
So I'm guessing, based on that, that your curriculum in high school and probably beyond didn't include much African history.
No, not much at all.
Right. So if I were to tell you or ask you to guess one place where America has fought a war in West Africa, do you have a guess for a time and place?
A time and place? I mean, I'm going to say now, too, that I'm very map blind. So, like, West Africa, I couldn't tell you geographically where that is comparatively, but I would say maybe Sierra Leone?
We've definitely been there, but that is not the topic today. As far as I'm aware, we haven't been there quite as directly as today's topic. Do you know anything about the country of Niger?
Very little. That was not even going to be one of my guesses, so.
No, it wouldn't. Why would it be, right? also called Niger, it is one of the few places in the world where I feel like pronouncing the name correctly is important, because it's right next to Nigeria.
Yes.
And talking about Nigeria, Nigerians, Niger, and Nigerians becomes plenty confusing without having similar pronunciation. To start off with a very light and happy subject before we get into gruesome deaths, where do you think the name Niger came from?
Ooh, that's a good question. I know that in a lot of languages, versions of that word, like Nero and Nira, and that similar words mean black. So that would be my first instinct, which tells me that it's probably wrong.
Well, that was my first instinct, too. And I think that's what a lot of people assume, because, sure, these were colonized places in sub-Saharan Africa. Why wouldn't Europeans call some large chunk of it
black?
The black place.
Yeah.
Like, that's in character for all of fucking European colonization.
Yes.
But believe it or not, it's not even the slightly racist version of that, where it's just, that's the name for a color. The ancient geographer Ptolemy of Alexandria referred to a river called the Niger, somewhere south of modern Algeria, as early as the 2nd century CE. And it probably comes from a local word in the Tuareg language, Gara Nagarawan, which is the river of rivers, which any crossover listeners from History of Persia will appreciate some similarities there. Mm-hmm. Normally, this is where I would do a brief history of a place the United States has sent our military that most Americans don't know anything about. But the oldest stone tools in Niger date back almost 300,000 years. So this is going to be a very abbreviated history.
That's a lot of context.
Yeah, we don't need to go quite all the way back to the Paleolithic for today's topic. Weirdly enough, the early colonial powers of Europe started founding their colonies as really just trade outposts on the Atlantic coast of Northern Africa in the 1400s, beginning with Portugal. But despite being significantly closer to Europe than the Caribbean, European powers just kind of ignored most of Africa for the first 400-ish years of colonization. So it wasn't really until France accidentally started the process of Europeans invading Africa in the 1830s when they conquered Algiers, that things really got going. But they really got going, and it's called the Scramble for Africa, is basically every colonial power and a bunch of powers that weren't all that colonial tried to carve up the continent before they were left out of this bizarre and genocidal race.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of the 19th century, so in the course of about just 70 years, most of Africa is divvied up among all of the European powers, and it stayed that way until after World War II, when colonies and colonialism basically went out of style.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like it got really unpopular for some reason. There was like a thing that was happening at the time where people took a good hard look at how they treated one another and minority groups politically. And there was just a bad look that they reassessed how they were going to colonize all of these places by technically making them independent.
Yeah.
Emphasis on technically in a lot of cases.
Not growing an actual conscience, but just being aware of the optics of the situation.
Yeah, it looks much better to say, well, we gave them their freedom than, well, we killed a million people in the Congo. Like, one of those mm-hmm. just sounds nicer. That will be a factor going forward today. Niger was part of the French Empire until the 1950s, and then France tried to do its own sort of British Commonwealth thing that didn't work out, and Niger got its independence in the 1960s. Except Niger is a prominent producer of uranium, and France uses more nuclear power than everybody else in the world, so they didn't really stop taking Niger's resources.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They just kinda started paying for them.
Kind of started paying for them.
Yeah, you know, like, they weren't paying what the uranium is actually worth to the French, but they were paying something.
Mm-hmm.
The former Nigerian president, Mamadou Tanja, provides his own interesting example or window into Nigerian history all by himself. He was born under French rule in 1938 and grew up during the transition, going on to join the first independent Nigerian army, which made him a colonel, and then he helped overthrow the first Nigerian republic.
Ooh, okay.
Installing a military junta that lasted for decades. But he personally transitioned out of the military into civilian government under the junta and became an activist for democracy.
Wow.
You get the sense that it was much more that, like, he was in the military when the military did a coup, then he was really invested in couping the government.
Mm-hmm.
So he was part of the transition back to democracy in 91, ran and lost the presidency in 93. They had a brief second junta in the late 90s. And in 1999, they transitioned back to democracy again. And Mamadou Tanja became president of Niger, marking a major shift away from government by the country's dominant ethnic groups, and just about as free and fair an election as anywhere in West Africa had ever had. He settled longstanding border disputes, and in general, he wasn't universally beloved or seen as a terrible despot, which is a pretty good place to be as the leader of a country.
Absolutely.
I don't want to make it sound like he was a saint or anything. His first term was marked by student protests when his administration slashed grant funding, and there was an actual military mutiny because they weren't getting paid. And he banned the press from reporting on any of this as they committed human rights violations in the hundreds, cracking down on these protest movements.
Sounds right.
Yeah, but still not, like, not a really abnormal place to be as far as leaders of countries go. Like, that's not an odd arc for most American presidents either, cracking down on student groups and committing human rights violations.
Very that.
Like, we get that in the news all the time.
It's also, you're just coming off of a military junta, so it feels like the aftershocks as things sort of try to find a new foundation. There's going to be some unfortunate growing pains that look like politics.
Yeah, the previous bar was in hell, so
yeah, exactly.
They're doing all right.
Not everything is on fire. It's a start.
But now we've kind of overshot.
Okay.
Before we move on with Tanja's presidency, we need to jump across the Atlantic Ocean in the year 2001, while the United States is our perpetual main character on this show. Can you think of anything important that might have happened in the USA around 2001?
Oh, gosh. It, America was having a time with 9/11 in 2001.
Yeah. 19 men boarded 4 planes taking off from Boston, Newark, and D.C., crashed them into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a field in Pennsylvania because somebody on United Flight 93 had the biggest fucking stones available in the U.S. that day. Mm. These 19 hijackers were a Lebanese man, an Egyptian, 2 Emirati nationals, and 15 men from Saudi Arabia. So naturally, the administration of noted painter and war criminal George W. Bush,
Afghanistan,
immediately launched an invasion of Afghanistan and began working on a way to blame Saddam Hussein in Iraq for the attack.
Right. This, yeah, some confusion there.
While our government did that, everybody in the United States promptly lost their goddamn minds for about a decade. And little 4-year-old Trevor got his first permanent visual memory while watching TV around 9 a.m. that morning.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I am sure that had no long-lasting effects on my psyche.
No, perfectly normal thing to have gone through that everybody remembers exactly where they were that day. Perfectly normal.
Uh-huh. I'm at right that bottom cusp where most people exactly my age do not remember, and I'm like, nope, possibly the only crystal clear memory I have is watching that little black TV in my mom's bedroom. Like, but it's seared in there. In all fairness, Osama bin Laden was actually directing Al-Qaeda and claimed credit for the attacks from Afghanistan. And Saddam Hussein was a monster who committed crimes against both Iran and his own people. Also, in fairness, the Taliban government actually offered to hand bin Laden over to the United States before we ever invaded, and the Bush administration declined.
What?
And everything about the Second Iraq War is a quagmire of unfathomable proportions, but we're not talking about those wars today.
Okay, because that would be a lot in one episode, for sure.
No,
oh,
that would and might be a 40-episode series.
Yes.
The invasion of Afghanistan was officially labeled Operation Enduring Freedom, a name I am sure most listeners are pretty familiar with 23 years later. Given that it remained our official name for the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan for approximately half of my life.
Wow.
But I don't know how many people are familiar with the OEF extended universe.
No.
Much like Marvel movies, the global war on terror started running out of well-known characters to feature faster than they ever really expected and started turning to a back catalog of countries to send American forces into. So we got Operations Enduring Freedom - the Philippines, the Horn of Africa, Penkisi Gorge, Kyrgyzstan, the Caribbean and Central America for reasons that I cannot figure out, and Trans-Sahara. So if you hadn't guessed, it's that last one we're talking about today.
Right, right. I'm not familiar with several of those. So yeah, it definitely was under a wide obfuscating umbrella.
Yeah. And many of those started well after 2001. Trans-Sahara in particular starts in 2007. I believe Enduring Freedom, Caribbean and Central America didn't start until like 2011 or 2012, and there's very little information on it. So I think many of these changed names, and I think that one probably changed very quickly.
Right.
Like they pitched it with that name for funding and then immediately called it something else after that. Back in Niger, one of the major projects in President Tanja's second term was breaking the French's mining monopoly over Nigerian uranium.
Mm-hmm.
They partnered with a Chinese firm, which gave Niger more bargaining power on both fronts to raise the price of their most valuable export. The problem was that very little of this money got reinvested into the actual region where they mine uranium in the northwestern Saharan part of the country. So the local Tuareg population, led by the Niger Movement for Justice, launched a revolt on February 6th of 2007 by attacking a series of military bases and demanding investment and reform from their government.
Justifiable.
Yeah, it's not an inherently unreasonable thing to have an insurgency over. You know, especially if you're just barely 6 or 7 years out of a junta, you're going to, like, there's going to be military solutions proposed to things like this. That's a lot of world politics.
Yes.
The thing is, while Al-Qaeda famously had no presence in Iraq before 2003, they sure as hell did by 2007.
Mm.
It turns out that when extremist movements are gaining traction in a large swath of the world, destabilizing a country in that part of the world leaves the door wide open for all of those groups to come in and try and seize power. So this was right in the middle of the American surge tactics in Afghanistan, where we just shoveled people into the country in hopes that they would be able to put down the rebellions there. West Africa had more than its fair share of religious insurgents, but none of them ever really gained traction. And the United States and France were both concerned that a rebellion of any sort in the region would lead to it becoming a new Al-Qaeda stronghold.
Right.
So they launched Operation Enduring Freedom's Trans-Sahara. This was mostly focused around the French providing actual people to do the fighting and the U.S. providing logistical support.
Naturally.
Because it was a former French colony, the French had infrastructure there, and they did have a lot of defensive pacts with their former colonies because everyone knew that they were the ones with all of the guns, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The only real conflict that the Americans encountered directly during these early couple of years in the area was the fighting spilled over into Mali on Niger's northern border, and an American MC-130 cargo plane was fired on by Tuareg rebels with rifles. This is an airplane. They're using probably some version of an AK-47. This was not going to do any damage to the plane, but they did. They landed and saw that there were some bullet holes in the wings and the chassis, but nothing that actually affected the functioning of an airplane.
Right? Okay, it's a rifle.
Yeah, the bullet's about millimeters in diameter, and this is a plane.
I'm kind of impressed that they actually hit it.
It must have been landing or taking off or something. It's the only way I can even imagine, like, they hit it more than once.
Right.
And this was also right as the American drone program was getting really big.
Of course.
So this was one of the incidents cited as a reason to invest in deploying drones in more places, because there was no risk to a person in the plane if there was no person in the plane to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the sole ethical basis for the drone program. And kind of works if it's carrying cargo or just has cameras on it. Like, that logic works out a little bit more before you strap bombs to the thing.
Right. I don't think there's any drones carrying cargo now. Like,
Amazon's working really hard on it.
Well, that's true.
And I assume that if you can strap a missile to it, you could, you know, put a box of anything there in the same spot. It would be able to take off.
Something non-explosive. What a thought.
Or it's still the military, even just smaller explosives.
True.
But this is also a point where Niger runs into a bit of a problem of its own. The Tuareg revolt was winding down by about 2009, and it formed the backdrop to the end of President Tanja's second term in office. Niger had a two-term limit on its president, not surprising for a country with a history of military dictatorship.
Yeah.
But Tanja's party started protesting in the streets to extend his term.
Of course.
He actually made no public comment about this whatsoever for months, and it generally seemed like he wasn't going to push for it.
Mm.
Until his party forced a constitutional reform through their National Assembly, at which point he said, well, the people want me back, so I guess I have to run for president again.
Ah, convenient.
Yeah. In July of 2009, there was another military coup to oust him from power before he could go that far. And this was actually, unlike a lot of similar coups in West Africa and the rest of the world, a genuine temporary government until they could sort out this whole democracy thing and get that back in place. They had free elections once again in 2011.
Mm.
It really was just an interim martial law situation.
Was that legislation extending his term repealed in that process?
As I understand it, it never formally passed.
Ah, okay.
In the same period of time, the United States had its own elections and new president. And the new Nigerian president, Mamadou Issoufou, was now negotiating with Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's one thing Barack Obama should be known for militarily, it is that his administration loved drones.
Yeah.
The drone program exploded under the Obama administration, both metaphorically and very literally most of the time.
Very literally.
Well, the drones didn't explode, but like school buses did.
Horrifying things. Yeah.
Yeah. Like war crimes, like terrible, terrible war crimes committed by Death Sky robots piloted by 19-year-olds in Virginia.
Mm.
Because we think we need fiction to have a robot apocalypse.
Right? Oh, man.
Yeah. It's here. It's already up there. It's not Skynet. It's Dave from down the street.
And robot dogs. I mean, it's all bad.
Oh, we're gonna be seeing those doing this stuff in like 3 to 5 years, guaranteed.
Terrifying.
You know, the one thing I trust is that robot dogs will not make all of the same mistakes we're going to talk about today. But I do have a question for you, Bree.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen the new Spiced Coat product?
Yeah, yes, I have.
For anybody who hasn't seen this, it's a raspberry cinnamon version of Coca-Cola. And I am willing to offer the Coca-Cola Corporation free publicity on this very podcast in perpetuity on one condition. You get rid of this thing and you bring back Cinnamon Coke,
oh.
Which was a limited edition Christmas release several years ago that was infinitely better. And until my demands are met, people will just have to deal with whatever ads come next.
Amazing. There's some spiced Coke in my fridge right now.
In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him, who should succeed him? Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world, thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
Right. And we're back for the year 2013. just flying along here, and it's going to slow down a lot. In 2013, Operation Enduring Freedom Sub-Sahara was renamed to Juniper Shield by the Obama administration, mostly as a branding exercise. Around this time, a lot of those different OEF submissions got renamed, like the one in Afghanistan became Operation Freedom Sentinel.
Okay.
And the one in the Philippines became Operation Freedom Eagle.
Oh, these are just
USA.
So brilliant.
USA.
Yep. This is giving me freedom fries and freedom toast vibes for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Well, all of this actually is a big part of the whole We Hate France freedom fries debacle, because yeah. This gave something in the war on terror for France and the United States to bond over and mend that wound in West Africa.
Wow.
But 8 years after the fact, after launching this campaign, they'd killed Osama bin Laden. 9/11 was so last decade, and come on, my fellow Americans, these wars are totally different.
Mm-hmm.
They were not remotely different. But they did successfully rebrand the drone strikes as a more humane, somehow, form of war. Down the line, that publicity wore off pretty quickly. And Niger kind of saw that writing on the wall, because they refused to allow the U.S. to station armed drones in their country. They would only allow surveillance drones to provide technical support to the militaries operating across their borders in Nigeria and Mali, where there was more direct conflict. So 150 American soldiers arrived in the Nigerian city of Arlit to operate their first drone base in West Africa. Though by 2015, we had signed an official status of forces agreement to start up a second airbase, and by 2018, there were 800 troops in the country.
That's a big jump.
Most of these were construction crews working on a second base outside the city of Agadez. This base was officially called Irien 201, and yeah?
Yeah, how's that spelled?
Bree is giving me a face of complete confusion.
Yep.
A-E-R-I-E-N-N-E.
Okay.
201.
Not Arian 201.
You can see how that would be an important distinction that nobody thought of while they were coming up with this name.
No kidding. That's particularly not helpful here.
No. In West Africa.
Yeah, exactly.
I bet if we had been putting it in Germany, though, that name would have been crossed off the board immediately.
Yeah.
Somebody would have caught it thinking about that connection.
Yeah, for sure.
But this base has been a resource sink since construction began in 2016. And I say has been.
Oh, my God. It's...
Because it is still not finished yet in the year of our Lord 2024.
It's not finished. I was thinking you were going to say it's still active. It's being used and they're sinking resources, but the building is not finished.
The actual original plans laid out on paper in 2016 have not all been completed.
Okay. This is okay. Incompetence?
Yes.
Okay.
This base was originally constructed with the intent to station more C-17 cargo planes there, because they're just big, bulky planes that require a larger facility than the one available at Arlit, where they were running the drone mission.
Right.
But wouldn't you know it, they're also about the same size requirements as a MQ-9 Reaper drone. The ones that carry things like Hellfire missiles, an actual a real name for a munition that this country uses.
Yep, that just felt bad everywhere.
Mm-hmm. The Reaper with Hellfire. We were like, we are an army of freedom and peace.
I mean, that's generally my like spooky aesthetic and everything, but in this context, the worst.
Yeah, great for a spooky aesthetic.
Yeah.
Your government should not have one of those.
like freedom.
No. So naturally, the Department of Defense Inspector General absolutely panned the whole damn project for neglecting basic safety and security requirements from the DOD, avoiding congressional oversight at every turn, and not even completing their own terrain surveys, which especially became a problem because they built this place as an airfield.
Right.
But there's no drainage.
Oh, excellent.
So every couple of months, the runway disintegrates and has to be rebuilt.
And they didn't do the survey prior to figure this out.
No.
Awesome. Everything's off to a great start.
Official documents about construction from U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, use a lot of words like miscellaneous light and medium load aircraft and force protection measures, with no specifications of what kind of aircraft that actually means or what sort of fortifications are being built on site.
Not suspicious at all.
Well, according to the Inspector General's report, the base may be in violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act by dipping into other pools of funding beyond their allotted construction budget to purchase 12 custom-designed air-conditioned guard towers to the tune of $3.7 million.
Okay. All right.
And then using their actual construction budget to build facilities for 3 unauthorized programs not specified in the report, possibly because it's not even clear to the DOD what those programs actually are.
There's a lot of distraction happening here.
Uh-huh. Those programs cost $5.7 million to build the buildings for.
Great.
And obviously did not have congressional approval. But don't worry, despite spending extra money on guard towers, they did cut some corners, paying a cheaper local contractor to put up a plain steel wire fence like you might see at a public park, instead of, like, walls that meet the DOD's security requirements for a military base in a combat zone.
Perfect. Very secure.
They also did not build any dedicated firefighting facilities at this base that's going to be full of airplanes and bombs.
Yeah, why would you need that? Why would you need fire?
No, you wouldn't. It's not like, you know, civilian airports have firefighting teams at the ready at all times because it happens frequently.
Oh my god, so frequently.
But this wasn't as much a concern because they didn't have dedicated ammunition and munition storage either. So the bombs and bullets and things were just kind of out and about throughout the facility.
Oh, that's excellent. Not a recipe for a disaster.
No. Weirdly, this story does not end with this base exploding.
Okay, I thought we were going that way for sure.
Which is what it feels like it should build to.
Yes.
Though technically not done yet.
True. Still costing money.
Less likely given some recent events we'll talk about, but technically still a possibility. Base 201 also doesn't have basic utilities because they plan, it's in the desert, so water was always going to be a concern. But they plan to power it on solar panels in a place with constant sandstorms.
Great. Okay. Yep.
Okay. Which, you know, blot out the sun. Really good for solar panels, I hear. And there's no roads or sufficient nearby airports to bring in supply. So everything has to be trucked in. Initially, they estimated $203,000 a year for utilities. They are currently spending about $3.1 million annually.
Oh, yep. Well, they didn't do a survey. Why would they think about logistics?
No. You know, the military, why would they think about logistics?
Nope.
Not like one of the top 5 words in a word association process there.
What happened? Oh, man.
What happened is we do not understand. Let's see. Right. In 2018, another report from The Intercept tried digging into local opinions about their presence at Agadez, and reporter Joe Penny visited with several locals in the city. A sidewalk textbook vendor described it as another form of colonialism to us.
Mm-hmm.
And the principal of a local school, who asked to remain anonymous, alleged that either the U.S. military itself or its contractors were using Base 201 not just for airplanes, but as a cover for an illegal gold mining operation.
Oh. Okay.
You didn't see that one coming, did you?
Is this a whole... No. Is this a whole other angle to explore? Where's the gold now?
In reality, this is just one of many conspiracies that the locals linked back to the base. Uranium mining was also suggested, as was draining the sub-Saharan aquifer, which is the largest aquifer on Earth, but I don't quite know what our military would do with all that water once they had it.
And they don't have utilities at the facility, so what are they even going to do?
Yeah, so that one seems unlikely to me. The gold mining idea does have legs, though, because the President Isufu shut down a major gold mining operation in the northern part of the country with no warning or explanation in 2017. And eyewitnesses said a year later that it was still active.
Oh, I see.
So somebody is using that gold mine. And since it's such a well-known location, it seems unlikely that they don't have permission.
Right. Okay.
The problem with most of these stories about crimes committed by the Western forces in Niger and the surrounding region is that most of the stories are about white soldiers. And that is a wide variety of countries and possible options. Most likely referring to the French because they have the most people there.
Right.
But it's also not a lot to go on when it's an accusation like kidnapping or trying to investigate the sudden spike in STDs in the neighborhoods near the airbase.
Oh, yes. That's a classic. That goes back hundreds of years.
Uh-huh. Which I would have been like, well, that is terrible, but also that is what happens when you build an airbase.
Yes, exactly.
Or
any type of military base for the last several hundred years.
Yeah, any military facility.
Forever.
Forever. It's one of the constants in history is that where there are soldiers, there will be STDs.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it is not like there is not evidence of foreign soldiers being in places they are not officially stationed. Mm-hmm. On the Nigerian or on the Nigerian-Algerian border. In the city of Agualal, there was no formal Western military presence, which made it very surprising when an app called Strava, which is a fitness app that can link to your Fitbit, released a bunch of location data that showed a lot of activity in Agualal.
Ooh.
Fitbits are not particularly popular among locals in the incredibly impoverished country of Niger.
Yes, but soldiers love them. Fitness people love them. I've got mine right here.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, critical support to Comrade Fitbit.
Mm.
And I'm going to call for another ad break and hope that by some miracle, it is a Fitbit ad or Strava.
In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him who should succeed him. Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world, thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
So we are back. We just checked in on our own Fitbits to make sure they were exposing our secret locations to the wider public. I do want to say that information largely came from The Intercept. And going forward with the rest of these episodes, The Intercept especially is the best source of information for all of this stuff. They have been hammering on this beat for the past 5-ish years.
Interesting.
9-ish years, my bad. And just do not let up on it. It's incredibly impressive journalism. But, of course, Base 201 was being constructed in response to increased Islamist extremism in the wider area. And an important thing to understand about global terrorist organizations is that they are a bit like podcasts.
Okay.
Some are massive top-down corporations or governments. Some are genuine solo indie projects. And some of those can get very big and prominent, like Boko Haram in Nigeria or Dan Carlin on the internet.
I hate how well this comparison is working.
But those are officially still on their own. The terrorist groups you've heard the most about, your Al-Qaedas and ISISs, those are networks. Loose groups that affiliate with one another to share resources, information, and host digital conferences.
Oh, is that a shot?
Which, Bria, I do think makes you the Osama bin Laden of podcasting today.
I didn't know that was going to be my title today. Amazing.
But as I teased that out, I was like, oh, well, I've got to tie Bria or Ben into this somehow because the comparison is working out. And then you volunteered to guest. And I was like, perfect.
I'm going to post that in our network, no context, and wait for people to have a reaction. It's beautiful.
Easy a comparison. It was too easy a comparison to make, just period.
Incredible.
Fortunately, for podcasting, terrorists also have an important thing in common with leftists, fascists, and all people who work with extreme belief systems. At their core, they are petty bitches who will break off and declare their own organizations over esoteric ideological differences. You have an entire Patreon series dedicated to this concept, I believe.
Anti-popes.
A lot of these guys give real, I thought we were the jihadist front for Islam. No, we're the Islamic front for jihad energy. It's very Life of Brian.
Mm-hmm.
And just to really illustrate this, because this bizarre sequence of events has the dumbest possible ending. The groups that I am talking about today began in 1989 with the Islamic Salvation Front, which was a legitimate conservative political party in Algeria that gained enough popularity to almost win control of the country electorally, prompting a military coup against them, and they reorganized as the Armed Islamic Group to fight in the Algerian Civil War in 1992.
Okay.
6 years later, one of their commanders broke off to form a more international movement called the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat.
What a combo.
Solid name. Uh-huh. In response to the French invasion as part of Operation Enduring Freedom, the SGPC formally joined Al-Qaeda and became Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. In 2011, a faction of that Al-Qaeda branch decided they weren't active in enough countries, and they broke off to become the Movement for Oneness and Jihad.
Ah.
Which then had a split, and the splinter group became a group called Al-Murabitun, which also split, with one half joining ISIS, and the other half joining Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb.
Oh, okay, circling back.
Yeah, just full circle.
I love how the group for oneness is the one that splintered the most.
Yes, absolutely. And then that ISIS group breaks and fractures and consolidates with other groups in the region more times than is worth even getting into with this. Mm. But I just found it hilarious that eventually it came full circle. Speaking of the Islamic State, or IS, or ISIS, or ISIL, or Daesh, depending on what news coverage you happen to look at, this is where they become important.
Mm-hmm.
This mess of an organization originated in 1999, had its own series of splits and allegiances, and for anybody who wasn't following the news at the time, there were a couple of years between 2013 and 2016 where the Islamic State was effectively an actual country for a little while, governing a large swath of northern Iraq and Syria.
Mm.
This was the topic of my senior year of high school term paper. But basically everybody with any investment in the region whatsoever unified around fuck that guy and destroyed ISIS's little country.
Mm-hmm.
That just left a ton of loosely aligned groups that identify with the idea of IS all over the Muslim world, calling themselves provinces.
Right.
Of a state that only sort of ever existed.
Mm.
Through all of this, Niger had actually avoided too much trouble from the extremist movements. They were one of the most stable countries in West Africa at the time, and through most of the mid-2010s, which unfortunately means that their borders became staging grounds for insurgents fighting in Mali.
Mm, of course.
Because nobody was looking for them, right?
Like, mm-hmm.
Nobody is prowling Niger for fighting because they know it's somewhere else. This all really escalated around 2015 with an influx of refugees and militants alike fleeing from the Libyan civil war, a war that will be an episode of this podcast at some point.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Well, we have to get to the bottom of Benghazi.
Ambitious. Okay.
Yeah, that I'm going to do what Congress could not and prove the same thing that Congress proved. Which is that not much happened. But as part of American efforts to train and assist the Nigerian army, American Special Forces, aka the Green Berets from the 3rd Special Forces Group, started going out on patrol missions with their Nigerian counterparts.
Okay.
And that brings me to October 2nd, 2017. When a special forces team based out of Camp Wellum in western Niger, filed a mission plan to carry out reconnaissance near the town of Tilawa. This is Wellum, spelled O-U-A-L-L-A-M, for reasons that I can only assume make more sense in a local language.
That has some French overtones, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something in there, and yeah. I don't know every component of it.
Yeah. It's like the French, or the French-Canadian cardinal. O-U-E-L-L-E-T is Ouellet and not Ouellet.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure it is a combination of, like, mm-hmm. French-based translating and some local word that sounds similar enough.
Has to be.
Or... I'm totally wrong, and this is just how the BBC pronounced it.
I mean, we were just talking about a base called Aryan, so.
That's fair. Doesn't have to make sense. The thing is, there is what I can only really describe as extreme fuckery going on with this plan. They were filed by mid-ranking special forces officers as a simple reconnaissance mission. But they were based on intelligence that Dundu Shefu, a sub-commander in the Islamic State Greater Sahara, or ISGS, would be in town. And the goal of going to Tilawa was to kill or capture Shefu.
Okay.
Which is not reconnaissance, you might notice.
No, that's definitely active.
But because the plan just said reconnaissance, it was approved without going very far up the chain of command. Mm. And the Special Forces team swore after the fact that they didn't intend to deceive anybody.
Okay. It wasn't my intention.
I have to say allegedly here, but I think that this was allegedly not true for reasons that will become more and more clear.
Mm-hmm.
They include the phrase rogue element in a BuzzFeed article. So they went out with 8 Green Berets, 2 U.S. Army support personnel, a quote-unquote intelligence contractor, read shady mercenary, and 35 Nigerians from their country's security and intelligence battalion. Somewhere between Special Forces and the CIA.
Okay.
These units had never worked together before a day in their lives before going out on this mission. They had never even trained together. They did no drills to prepare for this specific operation, and they just hopped in their vehicles less than 24 hours after filing their mission request.
Winging it.
Just wait.
Okay.
Because the vehicles, including the ones the Americans were riding in, were technicals. Bree, are you familiar with the memeiest piece of modern military technology?
I don't think I am.
So, a technical is theoretically any vehicle as its base, but it's usually a modified pickup truck.
Oh, okay.
The Toyota Hilux is a particularly popular option in most of the world. You basically mount a heavy machine gun in the bed of a truck, maybe bolt some armor onto the side, and say you have a military vehicle.
I see. Okay.
It's not really the thing you expect a group of Green Berets to be riding around in, but this is what they had on hand at the time.
Awesome.
But pickup trucks don't have a ton of seating capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the Americans were riding in an unarmored Toyota Land Cruiser.
No, okay.
The Nigerians were mostly on the same page, except one of their cars had been provided by the American CIA and outfitted with specialized surveillance equipment.
The part they need for the apparent surveillance job.
Yeah, you know, I get why that car went out. The rest of them seem kind of questionable. So an 8-vehicle convoy set out from Camp Wellum on October 3rd. They got to Toloa and decided that their target wasn't in town.
Okay.
But they got a call on the radio that their guy had actually been seen recently just a little further north, still in Nigerian territory. Command and control was sending them a second team by helicopter. Unfortunately, helicopters are dangerous and fragile death traps that you should never get inside of if you can avoid it. And strong winds force this one to turn back, leaving Team Wellum to continue by themselves.
Also not very, like, inconspicuous for a reconnaissance, quote-unquote, mission, right? This is not very subtle.
No. Nothing about this is ever going to heat the level of subtle.
For spying. No, let's just be very loud and obvious.
No. Rusty pickup trucks with machine guns is the most subtle form of transportation.
So subtle.
So Team Wellum went north and they did find what they assumed to be an ISGS camp in the desert. But there was no sign of their target or any other people in the camp.
Okay.
The Nigerians burned the supplies and vehicles that had been left behind by the insurgents, and their commanders back at Camp Wellum ordered their surveillance drone to scout ahead to the north, leaving this infiltration team with no overhead surveillance whatsoever.
Oh.
But it's okay. They were just making the return trip. They just had to make an arc and turn around.
Mm-hmm. Easy.
Yeah, at 10:30 the next morning, they stopped in a village called Tongo Tongo, just to resupply, pick up some more water. Their field commanders questioned this. They thought going into town would be too dangerous, leave them too exposed. It wasn't a town they had been to before.
Bunch of soldiers showing up is definitely going to draw attention.
Yeah, but their commanders overruled them because, to be fair, they did still need to drink water to make it home. But unbeknownst to them, the village chief and his friends who they were negotiating terms of trade with just kept dragging the meeting out.
Oh.
After they had been meeting for almost an hour, they saw two men on motorcycles rocket out of town, driving off into the desert.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, if they'd had aerial surveillance, that drone might have noticed a large crowd gathering vehicles and preparing their weapons just outside of Tonga Tonga.
Oh.
This group of ISGS fighters would even release videos they had taken of themselves preparing for battle before this attack as propaganda in the months afterward. The convoy was barely 100 meters, one football field in American units, outside the village when a dozen technicals and 20 men on motorcycles with small rifles and submachine guns rolled up. They fired rockets. Some of the trucks even had mobile mortars built into them. And they basically cut the convoy in two, trapping nearly half behind an encirclement while the rest of the Americans and Nigerians tried to push forward.
Oof, okay.
The American commander, Captain Michael Pirozeni, took four Nigerians to try and get his men out from the land cruiser that had gotten stuck in the encirclement, but they couldn't penetrate the ISIS lines and had to flee themselves.
Mm.
That left three American staff sergeants, Brian Black, Jeremiah Johnson, and Dustin Wright, to try and escape in their Land Rover, only for one to be shot while trying to move the car and the other two to be shot fleeing on foot.
Oh, no.
We have very detailed information about their final moments as a group because Jeremiah Johnson's helmet camera was eventually recovered.
Oh, okay.
As the part of the group that wasn't encircled was trying to get to a different position and try and fight back, a fourth American sergeant named LaDavid Johnson and two Nigerians who were riding in the same truck as him got left behind.
Okay.
So as the ISGS ambushers were barreling towards them, these three guys ran off into the desert by themselves toward a single tree that could provide some sort of cover, and none of them ever made it there.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Which, what, the other guys had rocket launchers. What was a tree going to do?
Right. Well, and then what after that?
It was just the only option.
Yeah, you can, that only helps for so long.
Because their friends had left them behind and stolen their car.
Ugh.
This went on for an hour before they were able to get word out to American command over the radio, and then went on for another hour as the ISGS fighters started to encircle the second group from the convoy.
Oh.
People began sending their prepared final messages by text and email. They began destroying phones and radios to prevent them from falling into enemy hands. They thought they were going to die.
Yeah.
And that is when jet engines roared up from the sky and two French fighter jets flew over.
Ooh, okay.
They weren't able to identify friend from foe on the ground to open fire on anybody. But the fact that the Air Force had shown up meant that other vehicles were on their way, and
yeah,
the ISIS guys fled, but not before stripping the American dead and wounded of anything of value that could be carried off, including their boots.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a underprepared insurgency in a very poor part of the world.
Right.
But it also meant that, like, they took American radios and things,
yeah,
despite the attempt to destroy most of them. So it was not a good thing strategically, let alone the moral horror of 4 dead Americans and 5 dead Nigerians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the thing about the Tongo Tongo ambush is that I think we are culturally conditioned to think of war in a very specific way, a World War II sort of way.
Yeah.
Where warfare means massive armies fighting over territory and inflicting hundreds and thousands of deaths.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what modern warfare means.
Yeah.
Especially when your country is playing a support role like this. This was the largest number of casualties sustained by American troops in Africa in over 30 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we, you know, we've never had a huge number of people in Africa, but we have had people in Africa in some capacity for most of our history.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this was the largest in recent memory.
And so preventable.
And immensely preventable. For comparison, in the entire much, much larger war against ISIS, ooh, that will show up on the recording.
Was that thunder?
Yeah.
Oh, I heard it from here.
I am in an attic.
Oh, okay.
In the entire much, much larger war against ISIS in Iraq, there were 16 Americans killed in combat.
Whoa, okay.
So the Islamic State killed a full 25% of the total number of Americans they killed in Iraq at just this one ambush.
Wow.
Plus 5 Nigerians.
Mm-hmm. That is wild. You're absolutely right that we think about it so much on such a larger scale.
Yeah, it's we think of war movie wars,
mm-hmm.
But that's not the type of war really anybody has fought outside of Ukraine, Iran, Iraq, and that's really it in decades.
Mm-hmm.
Just for clarity, the dead Nigerian soldiers were Gube Muhammadu Isaka, Yakuba Isufu, Bagwe Sumana, and Abdul Rashid Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't find specific details on which parts of the battle they were in.
Right.
Partly because our soldiers have helmet cameras that make that easier to document.
Right.
The morning after the ambush, President Muhammadu Isufu issued a public condemnation of the attack, followed by a moment of silence and 3 days of national mourning in Niger.
Mm-hmm.
The presence and boldness of such heavily armed attackers within their borders led President Isufu and his government to reconsider the presence of armed drones on their soil,
officially
giving the U.S. permission to put them in the capital city of Niamey on November 30th of 2017.
No, that's not good.
And on one hand, no, that's bad. On the other hand, if you're going to be putting people in combat roles, which they weren't supposed to be doing, but they ended up being there,
mm-hmm.
You shouldn't have to play a game of telephone with the French to get air support.
Yeah, this is very true.
Just from a military perspective, you should have your own military infrastructure if you're going to be in that position.
Yeah.
But they didn't tell anybody they were going to be in that position.
That's the thing. You know, if you want the air support, don't run it off as a reconnaissance mission.
Yeah.
Or take properly armored vehicles. That's a thought.
Yeah. Like, provide your soldiers with your own equipment instead of having them rely on a literal suburban SUV.
Oh, yeah. That's just so underprepared.
Over in the United States, Isufu's counterpart, President Donald Trump, was having just a hell of a week. Tongo Tongo happened just a few days after the mass shooting in Las Vegas, Nevada that year.
Oh, okay.
The deadliest of that sort of attack in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump was on Air Force One leaving Vegas when he received word of the ambush.
Ooh, okay.
And look, personally, Fuck Donald Trump.
Yep.
But damn, that has to be a rough day, even for him.
Yeah.
Like, not that it being rough prevented him from allegedly being cruel to the families of the four soldiers who had been killed.
Oh, of course not.
Which he and his staff vehemently denied on social media. I could dwell on that and go into it, but there's no point. Everyone's pretty much made up their mind about Donald Trump at this point, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to be the one to change them. Clearly, I'm in the "I'm certain he was cruel and callous to those families" end of things, but mm-hmm. it was in the news back then. If you want the specific details for some masochistic reason, please go ahead and look them up yourself. The White House and the Department of Defense certainly didn't help things by not keeping those families up to date on the investigation into what exactly happened.
Oh.
With those families finding out basically at the same time as everybody else on social media.
Oh. Okay.
And that sucks.
Yeah.
My brother is in the Navy. He's done some on the ground stuff. I can't imagine how that would feel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
On the colder, logical end of things, I also get it. The DOD was trying to piece these stories together from mismatched evidence, and the exact string of events was changing so rapidly that once the media got a hold of it, they were trying to appease the news cycle before they could even get the story together.
Of course.
Because once it was public knowledge, they had to explain themselves somehow.
Yep.
And like, that is the double-edged sword of immediate transparency, is they're transparent even if they don't necessarily know what it was.
Yeah.
And the news cycle is fickle, and it drops a story faster than it can develop.
That's for sure.
So if people remember this at all, they probably remember high-ranking officials like Defense Secretary James Mad Dog Mattis and Nikki Haley, then UN ambassador and now bizarrely optimistic presidential non-candidate, making a bunch of embarrassed non-committal statements to the press.
Mm.
Which, for one of them, is what she's doing now.
Yeah.
Again, I do not like any of these people, but in this case, that's not really their fault. It took 6 months before they had a clear idea of what went wrong, but our media ecosystem does not accept a 6-month waiting period.
Oh, absolutely not.
By the time they had a full picture of events, the news had moved on and most of America had probably forgotten this ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why it is now on a podcast called Secret Wars.
Yeah, it's right on brand, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So, over the following year, ISGS took formal responsibility for the attack. The officers and soldiers in U.S. AFRICOM who could be held responsible were formally reprimanded. Tuareg rebels found Jeremiah Johnson's helmet footage in Mali. And returned it to the U.S.
Mm.
And French special forces led a more organized raid on Tongo Tongo with the Nigerian security forces, where they killed 15 ISGS fighters, destroyed 20 motorcycles, and arrested the chief of the village for collaboration with the enemy, which
clearly had happened.
You hear a story like that in isolation, you're like, colonial oppressor, and then you hear the full story, and it's like, well, he definitely did that.
Definitely was collaborating.
Because these guys were 100 meters outside of his town.
And people left the town to get them ready.
Yeah, I get that choice. So just to break up the doom and gloom, we are going to cut to ads and come back with something more recent and very stupid.
Well, I love stupid.
Gamarjoba. My name is Roberto, and I would like to sincerely thank you for taking the time to check out my podcast, The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. In all likelihood, I would venture to guess that you found us because you were searching for either podcasts, YouTube videos, blogs about the history of Georgia, or you're hearing this on another podcast, like this one. I'm both sorry and happy to report that this beautiful and fascinating country is, to my great surprise, criminally underrated in the history world. As of now, this is the only podcast I am aware of dedicated to the full history of a nation and a people that have served as the battleground for empires all throughout European and Asian history. But the land of the Kartveli is so much more than that. The birthplace of wine, the second Christian kingdom, the land of fantastic food, nearly superhuman dancers and musicians, and perhaps, most importantly, a people that have preserved their culture, pride, and independence after centuries of one conquest after another. Empires rise and fall, but Sakartvelo always seems to survive in the end. So, let us celebrate this beautiful land by coming with me on this journey from prehistory to the present day, right here at the History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. You can find us on Twitter at @history_Georgia. Sakartvelo is spelled Sakartvelo. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
Well, all right, let's go back to it.
Yep.
So, Bree, an important thing to know about modern American war, much like American industrialism, is that we love to outsource as much as we possibly can.
Yep, okay.
Are you familiar with America's preference for paying other people to do jobs for
us? Yes, absolutely.
In the case of the military, that means construction, food, utilities, shipping, diplomatic security, even military training can all be pawned off to military contractors. Sometimes these are scary, violent mercenaries, but more often than not, they are the pencil pushers that the U.S. military doesn't want to pay for themselves.
Right.
So you remember base... Ariane 201?
Oh, I do.
Well, they contracted an American company called Amentum, which does all sorts of stuff for the government. Amentum subcontracted their work to an Australian company called Austability.
Okay.
They, in turn, hired local Nigerians to provide security for the payroll for other Nigerians working at base 201.
Okay.
This weird kind of three-dimensional triangle-shaped scheme, there's probably a word for that, is actually a totally normal way to do business with the United States military.
Oh, sure. That's not complicated, or it's just not straightforward at all.
Yeah. If anybody remembers the idea of the green zone in Iraq, most of the amenities there function on a similar system. On November 3rd of 2022, these local Austability subcontractors were driving a van with $40,000 worth of Nigerian francs through Tadres, a neighborhood of Agadez just outside the base, which features a hookah bar, a soccer field, and an old man named Mohammed Ibrahim at his house where he and his friends like to sit and drink tea in the front yard.
Okay, I thought he was just like a central figure who is there all the time. I love it.
No, he's just a dude who lives in the neighborhood. And he and his friends, while drinking tea, got a front row seat as this van drove by, and a pickup truck carrying three or four men pulled up alongside them.
Oh.
With a Type 80 mounted machine gun in the back.
Oh, no.
And as Mohammed Ibrahim said to The Intercept, they followed the van in from the city, and once they were in the open, they passed in front of the van and opened fire.
Oh.
They shot a few bullets, the van stopped, and one of the bandits got out and grabbed the bag of money. And then they were gone.
Great. Was this van a technical? I mean, it doesn't have any support again.
No, this was just a van.
Just a van. Not even an armored van. Okay.
As I understand it. Just a van. Nigerian guys decided their lives weren't worth 40 grand. But an armed robbery outside of a American airbase was embarrassing for everyone involved.
Sure.
And nobody was really willing to explain what had happened. Amentum refused to explain why it even had a subcontractor there in the first place on the basis that that was a trade secret.
Oh, okay. What a good trade secret.
Yeah. Well, an anonymous source working with one of their subcontractors claimed that one of the Nigerians in the van had bragged about withdrawing the money from the bank to a WhatsApp group of almost 200 people.
Oh, this is like the Fitbits.
Yeah. Just, you know.
Why?
OPSEC people. Operational security. I understand having to explain this to, like, protesters on Instagram, but you'd really think the U.S. Army would know about this stuff.
Yeah, but they're not the U.S. Army. They're a subcontractor of a subcontractor of a subcontractor. How are you keeping track?
They're just guys from... They're just townies that some Australian company hired to handle cash for the Americans.
Oh my god. Like, a dude with a WhatsApp group. Ugh.
And this was just the most blatant of rising crimes connected to militants and street gangs alike in Tadres, despite the presence of a high-security military base right next door. Maria Garba, who runs the Neighborhood Recycling Collective and raises money for at-risk youth and orphans, noted that the American base took no steps to provide security for the surrounding area at all, despite their own resources and money driving through it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they have a metal gate. They're set.
Yeah, they have a chain link fence and air-conditioned custom guard towers with
no facilities.
With unique custom-made holes in the side for shooting your gun out of.
Oh.
And no firefighters.
Mm-hmm. No organization for the explosives either.
No, and the explosives are, I assume, inside the air conditioner.
How is this place not blown up?
Right? Like, that feels like it's supposed to be part of the story.
Yes.
Instead, it's just all these other things happening around it.
Oh, $40,000 just completely ripped off because of a WhatsApp group.
Yeah, because a guy posted on WhatsApp that he... See, if I were that guy, I'd be like... Well, who in here robbed me? There's only 199 people.
You might even recognize the guy as he jumps out of the truck.
Right,
and go,
like,
okay.
Just, like, look at the...
I recognize this is my fault already.
Do I recognize any of these pictures? On the bleaker end of things, though not as bleak as the last thing, or as the last violent thing, on the far side of Niger from Tongo Tongo, in the Diffa region... There was actually another battle in 2017. On December 6th, just 2 months after Tongo Tongo, American special forces were out on patrol with the Nigerian army near the city of Diffa, near the Nigerian border. Because we can't go a minute without something irresponsible happening, this story had to be leaked to the New York Times, which was a public relations issue for the U.S., because they had not publicly disclosed the fact that our soldiers were even in Diffa.
Ah.
Or to other military bases in Niger, despite years of local journalists actively reporting on it.
Right. Got it.
Like Tongo Tongo, this was not supposed to be a combat mission. In fact, it didn't even have a specific target the patrol was looking for.
Oh.
It was just... Americans and Nigerians going out to practice working together only to be ambushed.
Oh, no.
But note the word practice. Unlike Team Wellum, these guys were supposed to be there together and had actually, like, gotten to know one another. And fortunately for them, it seems to have been a smaller attack.
Did they have equipment? At least.
They probably also had their own surveillance drone still with them, which probably gave them a little warning.
Right.
They took no casualties and killed 11 insurgents identified with the Islamic State West Africa.
Right.
Which is another version of IS in the region. In light of the Tongo Tongo ambush, the army decided not to disclose this fight until it was leaked to the New York Times.
Oh.
Alongside 10 other undisclosed fights in and around Niger.
Got it. Okay.
Uh-huh.
10.
10.
Mm.
10 that mostly in places where we theoretically don't have troops.
They're not supposed to be.
Even Congress didn't know about these battles, which led to a lot more scrutiny and investigation into what the hell AFRICOM was doing in Niger.
Right?
In a BuzzFeed report from December of 2017, officials of the Nigerian government, the former State Department and DOD analysts, and current U.S. military officers off the record, all posted it squarely on the shoulders of American special forces for inaccurate mission plans that allowed them to circumvent the official rules of engagement.
Oh.
Because they were not supposed to go into combat situations by default, but by filing a mission plan that says it's just a routine patrol, it's reconnaissance. You can get permission to leave base and take equipment with you without having to explain that you're probably going to use it.
Right.
The same BuzzFeed report is the one that has at least one member of Congress describing Special Forces Command Africa acting as a rogue element.
Ah, there we go. Yeah. Well, it very much seems like that's a purposeful thing that they're doing. So.
Well, right. That seems to be the case. There is this kind of institutional culture in AFRICOM of doing cowboy shit, I think is the technical term.
Yep.
Like, you get to West Africa and you're like, oh, well, we don't have to follow the rules. There's no rules here, to the cost of not just local lives, but your own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And hundreds of millions of dollars in equipment and maintenance that you wouldn't have to do if you just filed a little extra paperwork.
Right, right.
The thing is, I am loath to give any credit at all to the U.S. drone warfare program, as we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But allowing armed drones to act in Niger does seem to have cut down on all of these random guys going out and getting into shootouts with ISIS in the countryside, because you don't have to send guys to go check on if there's a group preparing an ambush somewhere.
Sure. But this whole base that's supposed to be in Niger is supposed to be for surveillance anyways.
Yeah.
So if they had a surveillance drone, maybe they wouldn't need armed drones in the first place.
And that's the thing. The worst example is the worst example because the surveillance program didn't work the way it was supposed to.
Yeah.
And it was used as an excuse to insert the armed drone program anyway.
Exactly.
Ugh, yeah.
Worst.
So at this time, Niger was one of the most stable and comparatively democratic countries in its neighborhood. And if any good thing can come out of 20 plus years of American warfare against extremist insurgencies, you would think it might be sharing information on how to deal with them with other countries.
Right.
Even if it is largely motivated by how doing that will benefit France and the USA.
Yeah.
So this last part is really shitty. The issue with Western militaries providing so much aid in these wars, especially the French army deploying in its former colonies, is that previously unaligned people inevitably get caught in the crossfire of any conflict.
Yeah.
And their frame of reference is that these white armies invading from Europe are historically their oppressors, and in one case is literally their historic oppressors.
Yeah.
And in another case, their primary media coverage is the U.S. providing death by robot from the sky in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the other side, no matter how heinous their own crimes, is saying, we're here to run off the invaders, we're here to enforce the religion that you believe in, and this is really appealing, especially to groups that don't get along with the sitting government.
Mm-hmm.
So as the Islamic State, or Al-Qaeda, or Boko Haram, or whoever can carry out a few attacks and draw in further reprisals, it just creates new radicalized people to recruit from because they have been somehow personally harmed by the United States and France.
Mm-hmm.
In 2015, Niger had largely avoided direct extremist violence that plagued its neighbors. Even in 2017, after Tongo Tongo, those ambushes were an anomaly. Since 2018, there has been a massive spike all across the region,
mm-hmm.
to the point that the French started losing ground in most of the neighboring countries.
Oof.
This instability, combined with apparent Russian support for local governments in the form of the now famous Wagner Group of trying to coup Putin fame, led to military coups in Mali and Burkina Faso, right on Niger's borders between 2020 and 2022.
Mm-hmm.
This led France and its European allies to withdraw their forces completely.
Oh, yeah. Power vacuums.
Ending a 19-year mission in Mali and basically handing that role directly over to the Wagner Group.
Yep, right.
In Niger, they have barely gone a span of weeks without some sort of terrorist attack since early 2021.
Oof.
Yeah, it's not great. Which is why in July of last year, this instability contributed to placing Niger in the crosshairs of yet another coup d'etat.
Mm.
A new military junta was established, leading to a standoff the last few months of 2023 with other members of the Economic Community of West African States, a sort of local European Union equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And the new junta declared that it would evict all remaining French and American forces from within the country. France did this proactively last December. The U.S. withdrew its drones at the beginning of this year, 2024. And as far as I can tell from the news, we are still trying to negotiate a way to maintain some sort of presence. But that is very clearly a losing argument.
Yeah.
Based on the other three countries in the new military coup junta alliance. And that means that base Ariane 201, the money pit the Air Force has been pissing into for 8 years outside of Agadez, is effectively a dead-end project, almost $280 million of total cost later.
Oh my god. Yeah, okay. That is so much money.
Well, probably not a total dead end, because I'm sure the Russians will get a lot of use out of it in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I'm thinking about what it's filled with.
And we can just hope that they send us thank you cards.
Or it blows up, because I'm still not convinced it's not going to blow up.
Or it just, you know, it blows up, turns into a sinkhole, gets buried and swallowed by the desert. These are all actual possibilities.
And at this point, victimless crime, really. If they just, you know, yeah. The runways disappear, disintegrate, it's like it was never there.
Just reclaimed by the desert, like...
Exactly.
The mummy's tomb in the Brendan Fraser series.
I'm convinced this is what's going to have to happen. I mean, it's just so mismanaged. What are they going to do with it?
Well, Russia has already started providing support to the new junta, which formed an official alliance with Mali and Burkina Faso in a triumvirate of military dictatorship to fight their respective insurgencies without foreign support.
Got it. Oh, okay.
Which unfortunately sounds like it can't work worse than what they've been doing.
Yeah.
At least militarily. I'm sure it'll suck for everybody who's already there.
Yeah.
And I cannot stress enough that a huge part of the problem here is that the U.S., France, and their allies are not in West Africa for altruistic reasons, no matter what we say in press conferences.
Oh, yeah.
Not that altruism is really possible in global geopolitics, but, you know, this all started in 2007 with an ethnic revolt over being disenfranchised by their government.
Yeah.
The U.S. saw this as an opportunity to bring France on board with enduring freedom and keep uranium prices low for Western power markets.
That's the other thing. It's that uranium piece. Oof.
Yeah. And, you know, so there's a resource that's now up in the air between four military dictatorships when you throw Russia into the mix.
Yeah.
And a bunch of extremist insurgent movements.
Mm-hmm.
Who are rapidly gaining ground in the region with all the uranium.
Oh, yeah.
You know, fun extra fact there at the end.
I mean, that's not a surprise. It's surprising that that's what they would go for.
No, of course not. To the people of Niger, these are colonial occupation forces
mm-hmm.
coming to take from their mines and maintain consistent political control over the region, mm-hmm. which is what's happening.
Yep.
They also recognize that they share a mutual enemy in the fact that these extremist groups hate both the Nigerian government and France and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that we sent soldiers there to do good things for the local people.
Yeah.
There were just some mutually good things that they could also do.
Mm-hmm.
Every accident, civilian killed, injured, or forced out of their home in these wars could be framed as a casualty of that colonial intervention, because they were.
Yeah.
And that was a recruiting tool for these same movements to grow despite constant military victories against them.
Right.
And that is basically the situation as of when we're recording this.
Oh, it's a whole lot of stupid. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's stupid. And, like, this podcast is supposed to be funny and entertaining, but, like, I don't have a solution to offer here. Unless you've got a time machine and you can go back 100 or 200 years to set these countries up for successful independence.
Yeah.
Or, you know, my current solution would be abolish nation states, but that seems like more of a long-term goal.
Yeah.
So, I don't have a solution to offer. It's a developing situation that now is going on a 20-year history since we got the ball rolling there.
Right, yeah, it's wild.
Yeah. So, Bree, any final thoughts?
I mean, it's wild how incompetent the entire situation is. And I know that we say we should always assume incompetence or never assume malice where incompetence is just as good. But, for the love of God, 201 just needs to explode, because otherwise it's the biggest red herring of this story.
Every time it comes up, you're like, and this is the part where, oh no, they're stealing gold.
If this were a movie, it would be the after credit scene. You would just see something kick off and you just see the explosion and be like, well, that's that.
And the great thing is, every day that passes between the time I hit stop on this recording and when I hit post is another day where the universe could prove us wrong and blow it up anyway.
That'd be amazing. Then you could just add the narrator's note right at the end.
Yeah, that is the story of the U.S. occupation of Niger.
Wild.
Do you want to plug your show or any other projects you want people to know about?
Well, sure. If you want to come and find Pontifex, you can do so at Pontifex Pod on all of your social media platforms. You can find our show on all of your favorite podcatching services and at pontifex.podbean.com. Intelligent Speech, the online conference that makes me the Osama bin Laden of podcasting, is coming up in early 2025. Stay tuned for news on that. IntelligentSpeechOnline.com.
You know, when you guys announced that it was going to be 18 months, I was like, that's so long from now. And I'm like, oh, crap, 2025 is really close.
I know. Well, we did that like 15 months and 15 months so that we could, because we've been trying to get it to winter for like 2 years. And this was the only way to do it without having two like 4 months apart. And we would all die.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, everyone can find me online at History of Persia, because I'm not managing multiple usernames for this stuff. You can find more information about this show and resources like maps and a timeline at secretwarspod.com or hopfulmedia.com. Until next time, thank you all for listening to Secret Wars, and keep your eyes out for black market uranium.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.